or a gun. How many bullets do you have, precisely? I've already got the security team and some auxiliaries woken up and armed, Cast said stubbornly. We'll go down and make a beachhead, establish a base, start pushing out. We'll burn the fuckers. What else can we do? Nobody said it was going to be easy. Nobody said it would happen overnight.
Well, it might come to that, Vitas conceded. And if it does, I shall stay up here and coordinate the assault, and good luck to you. However, I hope there will be a more efficient way to dispose of our pest problem.
Lane, I'll need at least one of the workshops up and running at my direction, and access to all the old files, anything we've still got regarding Earth.
What's the plan? Lane asked, without looking back at her.
Brew up a present for the...
for them, below.
This time, Vitas's stutter was clear enough that everyone noticed it.
I don't think it should be impossible to put together some sort of toxin that will target arthropods. Something to eat away at their exoskeletons or their respiratory system. But that won't have any ill effect on us. After all, assuming they're derived from actual Earth spiders, they're essentially a completely different form of life to us. They're not like us at all, in any way.
Holston, listening, heard too much emphasis on those words. He thought of broken messages in Imperial Sea. Had it been Kern herself, or something just parroting Kern's words? In the end, he supposed, it didn't matter. Genocide was genocide. He thought of the old empire, which had been so civilized that it had in the end poisoned its own homeworld. And here we are, about to start ripping pieces of the ecosystem out of this new one. Nobody was paying attention to him, especially as he wasn't voicing any of these thoughts that entered his head, so he found a console that looked halfway operational and got into the comms system. As he had expected, there was a great deal of broad-frequency radio activity issuing from the planet. The destruction of the sentry habitat meant that nothing was coming to them now as clearly. Possibly it had been merely a powerful transmitter for the planet at the end. But the green world itself was alive with urgent, incomprehensible messages. He wanted to think of something wonderful then, some perfect message that would somehow bring comprehension in its wake, open a dialogue, give everyone options. The cruel arithmetic of Vitas's prisoners locked him down, though. We couldn't trust them. They couldn't trust us. Mutual attempts at destruction are the only logical result. He thought of human dreams, both old empire and new, of contacting some extraterrestrial intelligence such as nobody had ever truly encountered. Why? Why would we ever want to? We'd never be able to communicate, and even if we could, we'd still be those same two prisoners, forced to trust and risk, or to damn the other in trying to save slightly more of our own hides. Then there came a new transmission, from the planet direct to the ship, fainter than before, but then it was not using the satellite as a relay anymore. One word in Imperial Sea, but absolutely clear in its meaning.
Missed.
Holston stared, opened his mouth two or three times, about to draw someone's attention, then sent a simple message back on the same frequency. Dr. Avrana Kern?
I told you to stay away,
came the immediate, baleful response. Holston worked swiftly, aware that he was negotiating now not for the Gilgamesh, but as Earth's last classicist in the face of raw history. We have no option. We need to get off the ship. We need a world.
I sent you to a world, ungrateful apes.
The transmission came from the planet, pulsing strongly out of the general riot of signals.
Uninhabitable, he sent. Dr. Kern, you are human. We are human. We are all the humans there are left. Please let us land. We have no other choice. We cannot turn back.
Humanity is overrated, came Kern's dark reply. And besides, do you think that I'm making the decisions? I'm only an advisor. And they didn't like my preferred solution to the problem that is you. They have their own ways of dealing with trouble. Go away.
Dr. Kern, we are not bluffing. We really have no option.
But it was just like before. He was not getting through.
Can I talk to Eliza, please?
If there was anything left that was Eliza and not me, you've just destroyed it, Kern responded. Goodbye, monkeys.
Holston sent further transmissions, several times over, but Kern was apparently done with talking. He could hear the woman's contemptuous voice as he read through the impeccable Imperial Sea, but he was far more shaken with the ancient entity's suggestion that the creatures on the planet would not be held back even by her. Where has her experiment taken her? He glanced about him. Vitas had gone now, heading off for her workshop and her chemicals, ready to sterilize as much of the planet as was necessary so that her species could find a home there. Holston wasn't sure how much would be left of what made the place attractive for habitation after she was finished.
But what other choice have we? Die in space and leave the place to the bugs and to Kern?
We're still losing hull sensors, Alpash noticed. The impacts may have caused more damage than we thought.
He sounded genuinely worried, and that was a disease that others caught off him almost immediately.
How can we still be losing them?
Lane demanded, still concentrating on her own work.
I don't know.
I'm sending out a drone, then. Let's take a look,
Karst stated.
Here.
After some fumbling, he got the drone's eye view up on one of the screens as it manoeuvred somewhat shakily out of its bay and coasted off down the great curving landscape of the ship's hull.
Fuck me, this is patched to buggery, he commented.
Mostly from what we installed after the terraform station, Lane confirmed. Lots of opening her up and closing her back down to get new stuff in or to effect repairs.
Her voice trailed off.
What was that?
What now?
I didn't see,
Karst stated.
Something moved, Alpash confirmed. Don't be stupid.
Holston stared, seeing the lumpy, antennae-spiked landscape pass. Then at the corner of the screen, there was a flurry of furtive, scuttling movement.
They're here, he tried to say.
But his throat was dry, his voice just a whisper.
There's nothing out there,
Karst was saying. But Holston was thinking, was that some kind of thread drifting from that antenna? Why are the hull sensors going down one by one? What is that I see moving?
Oh, fuck.
Karst suddenly sounded older than Lane.
Fuck, fuck, fuck.
In the drone's sight, a half dozen grey, scrabbling forms passed swiftly over the hull, running with slightly exaggerated sureness out in the freezing, airless void, even leaping forwards, catching themselves with lines, leaving a tracery of discarded threads latticing the Gilgamesh's exterior.
What are they doing?
Alpash asked hollowly. Lane's voice, at least, was steady.
Trying to get in.
Chapter 7.6 Breaking the Shell. One of Portia's peers operates a bulky device of silk-bound glass that acts as an eye, containing a colony of tiny ants whose sole function is to create a compound view of the sites before them and relay it back to the orbital web and to the planet. The anchor can then give moment-to-moment orders to best exploit their new position up on the exterior of this vast alien intruder. This is just as well, for Portia would not have the first idea what to make of anything she sees. Every detail is bizarre and disturbing, an aesthetic arising from the dreams of another phylum, a technology of hard metal and elemental forces. Bianca herself has little better idea what to do with it, but the images are being rooted down to the vast colony complex that is Dr. Avrana Kern, or what is left of her. Kern can make an educated guess at what Portia is seeing, and offers her recommendations, some of which are taken, some of which are discarded. Kern has fallen far from her status as god. She and the leaders of her erstwhile flock have undergone some bitter disagreements about the fate of the human race currently aboard the Gilgamesh. She argued and threatened, and in the end she begged and pleaded. But by then the spiders had their assault planned, and were not to be swayed. In the end, Kern was forced to accept the hard decisions of those that had once been her faithful, and were now her hosts. Now she has identified the hull sensors for Portia and the other bands of orbital defenders. They have been busy crossing the hull to put out the Gilgamesh's eyes.
Portia has little concept of the living contents of the Ark ship at this point. Intellectually, she knows they are there, but her mind is focused on this stage of her duty, and the concept of a vast ship of giants goes further than her imagination will stretch. Nonetheless, her mental picture of the processes going on within is surprisingly accurate. They will detect us, and they will know that we will try and break in. In her mind, the Gilgamesh is like an ant colony, one of the bad old kind, and any moment the defenders must boil out, or else some weapons will be deployed. There will be a small number of hatches that lead to the interior, Bianca instructs. Continue to destroy sensors as you travel, to hamper their ability to respond. You are looking for either a large square... With meticulous patience, Bianca gives concise descriptions of the various possible means of access to the Gilgamesh's interior, as dredged from Avrana Kern's memory of her own encounter with the Ark ship. Where they launch their shuttles, where there are maintenance hatches, airlocks, drone chutes. Much is conjecture, but at least Kern was once of the same species as the Ark ship's builders. She has a common frame of reference, while Portia cannot even guess at the purpose or function of the profusion of details on the Gilgamesh's hull. If the spiders possessed a certain form of determination, then they would be able to enter the Ark ship without needing to find a weak point. After all, they have access to chemical explosives that carry their own oxygen and would trigger in a vacuum. Their space-age technology has its limits, though. Tearing the ship open is not a preferred option. If nothing else, Portia and her peers are intending to rely on the Ark ship's air, even though it is short of oxygen compared to their usual needs. The respirators about the spiders' abdomens have a limited lifespan, and Portia is keenly aware that they would prefer to return home across the void as well. Better to establish a controlled breach, and then seal it off once her spiders are inside. A curious sensation washes over her, like nothing she has experienced before, setting her tactile sense organs quivering. The nearest equivalent she could name would be that a wind had blown past her. But out here there is no air to move. Her fellows and other peer groups currently engaged on the assault have felt it too. In its wake, radio communications become patchy for a brief while. Portia cannot know that her adversaries inside the ship have improvised an electromagnetic pulse to attack the spider's electronics. The two technologies have passed each other in the night, barely touching. Even Portia's radio is biological. What little the pulse can touch of it is instantly replaced. The technology is mortal, born to die, and so every component has replacements growing behind it, like shark's teeth. Portia has located a hatch now, a vast square entryway sealed behind heavy metal doors. Immediately she broadcasts her position to nearby teams, who begin to converge on her position, ready to follow her in. She calls forwards her specialist, who begins drawing the outlines of the hole they will make with her acids. The metal will withstand them for a while yet, and Portia steps from foot to foot, anxious and impatient. She does not know what will greet them once they get inside. Giant defenders, hostile environments, incomprehensible machines. She has never been one to just sit and wait. She needs to plan, or she needs to act. Denied either, she frets. As the acid begins to work, reacting violently with the hull and producing a frill of vapour that disperses almost immediately, others of the team begin weaving an airtight net of synthetic silk between them, which will close up the breach once the team is inside. Then, radio contact is gone abruptly, swallowed by a vast ocean wash of white noise. The denizens of the Ark ship have struck again. Immediately, Portia begins searching for clear frequencies. She knows the giants also use radio to speak, hence it seems likely that they may have held some channels open. In the interim, though, her squad is cut off, as are all of the Hull squads. But they know the plan. They already have their instructions on precisely how to deal with the human menace. Both the waking crew and the vastly greater number of sleepers that Kern has described. The precise details will now be down to Portia's discretion. Uppermost in her mind at this point is that the inhabitants of the Gilgamesh are taking an active hand in their own defence, at last. She has no idea how this might manifest, but she knows what she would do if an attacker were gnawing at the walls of her very home. The porteid spiders have never been a passive or defensive species. No patient web lurkers they. They attack or counterattack. They are made to go on the offensive. Without the radio, close-range communication remains possible. Just. Be ready. They will be coming. She taps out on the hull, flashing her palps for emphasis. Those not directly involved in breaching the hull fan out, watching to all sides with many eyes. Chapter 7.7 The War Outside.
Ha! Karst shouted at the screens. That screws over their fucking radio!
It's not exactly a killer blow. Lane rubbed at her eyes with the heel of one hand.
It doesn't deal with the implications of them having radio in the first place, Holston remarked. What are we dealing with here? Why aren't we even asking that question?
It's obvious, came the terse voice of Vitas from over the comms.
Then please explain, because precious little is looking obvious to me right now, Lane suggested.
She was concentrating on the screens, and Holston had the impression that her words had more to do with being irritated at Vitas's superior manner.
Kern's world was some sort of bioengineering planet, Vitas's disembodied voice explained. She was creating these things. Then, knowing we were returning, she's broken them out of stasis at last, and has deployed them against us. They're fulfilling their programming even after the destruction of her satellite.
Holston tried to catch the eyes of Lane or Karst, or indeed anyone, but he seemed to have faded into the background again.
What does that mean the surface is going to be like?
Karst asked uneasily.
We may have to conduct some widespread cleansing, Vitas confirmed, with apparent enthusiasm.
Wait, Holston muttered. Lane cocked an eyebrow at him.
Please, let's not repeat their mistakes, the Empire's mistakes.
Because sometimes I feel that's all we've been doing.
It sounds like you're talking about poisoning the planet to death so we can live on it.
It may be necessary, depending on surface conditions. Allowing uncontrolled biotechnology to remain on the surface would be considerably worse, Vitas stated.
What if they're sentient? Holston asked.
Lane just watched, eyes hooded, and it looked as though Karst hadn't really understood the question. It was now Holston versus the voice of Vitas.
If that is the case, Vitas considered, it will only be in the sense that a computer might be considered sentient.
They will be following instructions, possibly in a way that gives them considerable leeway in order to react to local conditions, but that will be all.
No, said Holston patiently.
What if they are actually sentient, alive and independent, evolved?
Exalted, came the word inside his head. The exaltation of beasts. But Kern had spoken only of her beloved monkeys.
Don't be ridiculous, Vitas snapped.
And surely they all heard the tremble in her voice.
In any event, it doesn't matter. The logic of the prisoner's choice holds. Whatever we are ranged against, it is doing its best to destroy us. We must respond accordingly.
Another drone gone, Karst announced.
What? Lane demanded.
With the hull sensors being picked off, I'm trying to keep tabs on the fuckers with drones, but they're taking them out. I've only got a handful left.
Any armed, like the ones that took down Kern? The old engineer asked.
No, and we couldn't use them anyway. They're on the hull. We've damaged the ship.
It may be too late for that, Alpash commented levelly. He showed them one of the last drone images.
A group of spiders was clustered at one of the shuttle bay doors. A new line in the metal was visible, flagged by a ghost of dispersing vapour down its length.
Fuckers, said Karst solemnly.
You're sure we can't electrify the hull?
That had been a hot topic of conversation before they tried the EMP burst. Alpash had been trying to work up a solution for a localised electrical grid around wherever the spiders were located, but the infrastructure for it simply was not there, let alone the enormous energy that would be needed to accomplish it. Talk had then devolved towards lower-tech solutions.
You've got your people armed and ready? I've got a fucking army. We've woken up a few hundred of the best candidates from cargo and put disruptors into their hands, assuming the little bastards can be disrupted. If not, well, we've broken out the armory. I mean... And his voice trembled a little. Small cracks evident from a deep, deep stress. The ship's so fucked, a few more holes won't make any difference, will they? And anyway, we can still stop them getting in. But if they do get in, we may not be able to contain them. He fought over that may, his need for optimism crashing brutally into the wall of circumstances. It's not like this ship was laid out with this kind of situation in mind. Fucking oversight that was. And a rictus grin.
Cast, Lane began. And Holston, always a little behind, thought she just wanted to shut him up and spare him embarrassment.
I'll get suited up, the security chief said.
Lane just watched him, saying nothing.
What? Holston stared. Wait, no!
Cast essentially ignored him, eyes fixed on the ancient engineer.
You sure?
Lane herself seemed anything but.
Cast shrugged brutally. I'm doing fuck all good up here. We need to go clear those vermin off the hull.
There was precious little enthusiasm in his voice. Perhaps he was waiting for Lane to give some convincing reason that he should stay. Her creased face was twisted in indecision, though. An engineer seeking a solution to a technical problem she could not overcome. At that point, Holston's console flickered into activity again, and he realized the attackers on the outside had located the clear channels that Cast had been using to control his drones, and that Cast would soon be using to communicate with the ship. It was Holston's job to notify everyone, the moment the spiders made this discovery, but he said nothing, part of him staring at the sudden patchy scatter of signals being picked up by the Gilgamesh's surviving receivers, the rest of him listening to the conversation going on behind him.
Your team?
Lane prompted at last.
My core team are suited and ready, Cast confirmed. It looks like we might have a fight the moment we open the airlock. Little bastards could be out there already, cutting in.
Nobody was arguing with him, but he went on.
I can't ask them to go and me stay behind.
And then,
this is what I'm for, isn't it? I'm not a strategist. I'm not a commander. I lead people. My team.
He stood before Lane like a general who had disappointed his queen, and now felt that he had only one way to redeem himself.
Let's face it. Security was only ever here to keep key crew and cargo in place for the duration of the trip. But if we have to be soldiers, then we'll be soldiers. And I'll lead.
Cast, Lane started, and then dried up. Holston wondered whether she had been about to say something bizarrely trite, some piece of social ornament like, if you don't want to go, then don't. But they were long past what people did or didn't want to do. Nobody had wanted the situation they found themselves in now, and their language, like their technology, had been pared down to only those things essential to life. Nothing else, none of the fripperies and flourishes, had been cost-effective to maintain.
"I'll get suited up," the security chief repeated tiredly, with a nod.
He paused as though he wanted to throw out some more military form of acknowledgement, a salute from those about to die, and then he turned and left. Lane watched him go, leaning on her metal stick, and there was a similar ramrod stiffness to her bearing, despite her crooked spine. Her bony knuckles were white, and everyone in that room was watching her. She took two deliberate steps until she was at Holston's shoulder, then glowered about her at the handful of tribe engineers still left in comms.
"Get to work," she snapped at them. "There's always something that needs fixing."
Having dispersed their attention, she took a deep breath, then let it out, close enough to Holston's ear that he heard the faint wheezing of her lungs.
"He was right, wasn't he?" she said very softly, for his ears only. "We need to clear them from the hull, and the security detail will fight better if Cast's out there with them."
It was not that she had told the man to go, but a word from her might have stopped him. Holston glanced up at her and tried to make himself nod, but something went wrong with the motion, and the result was meaningless and non-committal.
"What's this?" Lane demanded abruptly, noticing the stream of signals on his screen.
"They found our gap. They're transmitting."
Then why the fuck didn't you say?
She called out.
Cast?
Then waited until Alpash confirmed that she was connected to the man.
We're changing frequencies, so get your people ready.
Next, giving him the new, clear channel. Holston?
Vetus is wrong, he told her.
They're not biological machines. They're not just Curran's puppets.
And how are you supposed to have worked that one out?
Because of how they communicate. She frowned.
You've cracked that now? And didn't think to tell anyone?
No, not what they're saying, but the structure.
Issa, I'm a classicist.
And a lot of that is a study of language. Old languages, dead languages, languages from an age of humanity that doesn't exist anymore. I'd stake my life that these signals are actually language, rather than just some sort of instructions. It's too complex, too intricately structured. It's inefficient, Issa. Language is inefficient. It evolves organically. This is language. Real language.
Lane squinted down at the screen for a few seconds until the transmissions abruptly cut off, as the jamming switched frequencies.
What difference does it make? She asked quietly. Does it get Vetus's fucking prisoners out of their cells?
It doesn't, Holston.
But tell me how it helps us, she invited.
Tell me how any of this speculation does us any good. Or is it just like all the rest of your bag of tricks, academic in every sense of the word?
We're ready,
came Cast's voice at that moment, as though he had been politely waiting for her to finish.
We're in the airlock. We're about to open the hatch.
Lane's face was like a death mask. She had never been intended as a commander, either. Holston could see every one of those centuries of hard decisions in the lines on her face.
Go, she confirmed. And good luck.
Cast had a squad of 22 ready to go, and that used up all the heavy EVA suits that were still functioning. Another 12 were currently being worked on, and he was only grateful that the tribe had needed to go out and make patch repairs on the hull, or he might not even be able to field that many soldiers. Soldiers. He thought of them as soldiers. Some of them actually were soldiers, military woken up from cargo either this time or the last time. Added piecemeal to the security detail whenever he had needed a bit more muscle. Others were veterans of his team. Key crew who had been with him from the start. He was taking only the best, which in this case meant almost everyone who had the appropriate EVA training. He remembered very clearly when he himself had gone through that training. It had seemed a complete waste of time, but he had wanted to win a place in key crew on the Gilgamesh, and it had been something they had been looking for. He had spent months bumbling about in orbit, learning how to move in zero gravity, how to step with magnetic boots, acclimatizing to the nausea and the disorientation of such a hostile and inimical environment. Nobody had mentioned fighting an army of spiders for the survival of the human race, but Cast half fancied he might have imagined it, daydreamed it back when he was young and the Gilgamesh project was still just an idea. Surely he had seen himself standing on the hull of a mighty, embattled colony ship, weapon to hand, beating away the alien horde. Now in the airlock, his breath loud in his ears, and the suit's confines pressing and leaden, it didn't seem at all as much fun as he had imagined. The hatch they were about to exit through was set in the floor from where he was standing. There would be a vertiginous shift of perspective as they got out, carabinered to one another, and trying not to be flung off the ship's side by the rotating section's centripetal force. Then they would have to trust to their boots to hold them, progressing along a surface that would constantly try to dislodge them. Things would have been easier, perversely, had they been accelerating or decelerating in deep space, with the inner sense of down falling towards the front or the rear of the ship, and the rotating sections stilled. But they were in orbit now, free-falling around the planet, and therefore forced to fake their own gravity.
Chief,
one of his team warned.
We're losing air. Of course we're.
Then he stopped, because he hadn't given the order to open the external doors. They had been standing here on the brink for some time, and the words had been reluctant to emerge. Now someone, something, was forcing his hand. Somewhere on the hatch there must be a pinhole letting out their air. The spiders were out there, right now, trying to claw their way in.
Everyone latch down and lock your boots, he ordered.
And now he was faced with action. The thoughts were coming smoothly and without undue emotional embroidery.
You better crouch low. I want the outer door open quick as you like, without the air venting first.
One of the tribe confirmed his instructions in his ear, and Cast followed his own advice. Instead of the steady grinding of the hatch that he expected, someone had obviously taken that quick as you like to heart and activated some sort of emergency override, snapping the hatch open within seconds so that the pressurized air around them thundered through the resulting breach like a hammer. Cast felt it raking at him, trying to drag him out with it to enjoy the vast open vistas of the universe. But his lines and boots held, and he weathered the storm. One of his team was immediately torn loose beside him, yanked halfway through the opening, and only saved by her anchoring line. Cast reached out and grabbed her glove, clumsily pulling her back until she was against the subjective floor beside the gaping hole. He saw some fragments then, jointed legs and a torn open something that must have been most of a body caught by the mechanism of the hatch. Beyond were the enemy. They were in disarray, crawling over one another. Several had been battered away by the decompression, and he hoped that a few had been lost to space. But there were at least three or four dangling out at the end of threads, and beginning to climb back up towards the hatch. Cast aimed his gun. It was built into his glove, and was a refreshingly simple piece of kit, overall. Nothing in the airless wastes of vacuum would stop a chemical propellant working if it contained its own oxygen, and the airless void should be a perfect marksman's paradise, his range limited only by the curve of the Gilgamesh's hull. He wanted to say something inspiring or dramatic, but in the end, the sight of the creeping, leg-waving, spasmodically scuttling monsters so horrified him that,
"Kill the fuckers!"
was all he could manage. He shot but missed three times, trying to adjust for the surreal perspective, and mistaking the distance and size of his quarry, his suit's targeting system mulish about locking on to the little vermin. Then he caught it, sending one of the beasts that still remained on the hull spinning away. His team was shooting as well, careful and controlled, and the spiders were plainly utterly unprepared for what was happening. Cast saw their angular, leggy bodies being hurled away on all sides, the dead ones dangling straight out from the hull like macabre balloons. Some of them were returning fire, which gave him a nasty turn. They had some sort of weapons, though the projectiles were slow and bulky compared to the sleek zip of bullets from the human-made guns. For a moment, Cast thought that they were throwing stones again, but the missiles were something like ice or glass. They shattered against the armoured suits, causing no damage. The spiders were unexpectedly resilient, clad in some sort of close-woven armour that had them dancing about under the impact of the bullets without necessarily letting any penetrate. And Cast and his fellows had to hose several of them with shot before something got through. They exploded quite satisfactorily, though, once they died. Soon, if there were any enemy survivors, they had fled. Cast paused a moment, reporting back to Lane before taking the big step of putting himself outside on the hull, out before the curtailed horizon of the Gilgamesh. Then there was nothing for it, so he went. The heavy EVA suits were proper military technology, although most of the actual military systems Cast would have liked to have accessed were not online or had been removed entirely. After all, the engineers had not needed sophisticated targeting programs when going out to make repairs. Like everything else that survived of the human race, a tyranny of priorities had come into force. Still, the suits were reinforced at the joints and armoured everywhere else, with servos to help the determined space warrior actually move about in them. They had an extended air supply, recycled waste, controlled temperature, and if the hull sensors had actually been left intact, then Cast would have had a lovely little map of everything around him. As it was, he climbed laboriously through the hatch in a second skin that bulked out his torso and each limb to twice its actual circumference, feeling hot and cramped, sensing the slight shudder as ancient and lovingly maintained servo motors considered each second whether or not they would relinquish the ghost and seize up. Some of the suits still had functioning jetpacks to allow for limited manoeuvring while away from the hull, but fuel was at a premium, and Cast had given the order to save it for emergencies. He He was unconvinced that using the antiquated, oft-repaired flight packs was not just one step too far towards a death trap. His image of his surroundings was the cluttered and narrow view from his faceplate and a handful of feeds from cameras on his squadmates' suits, which he was having difficulty matching up to the actual individuals concerned.
"Lane, can you send everyone instructions on a formation and their place in it?"
It felt like admitting defeat, but he did not have the tools that the suit's inventor had anticipated to hand.
"I need eyes looking out every way. We're heading for Shuttle Bay 7, Dawes. Close this airlock behind us, and the outer door's compromised somewhere."
"It's not closing," came Alpash's voice.
"Something's gone wrong."
"Well..." And then Cast realised he had nothing much to say to that. He could hardly demand they came out and fixed it right now.
"Well, seal the inner door until we return. We're going now."
Then Lane's instructions came through, showing them her best guess at a route to take and a formation for the security team to fall into, eyes focused all around.
"We've got another drone launching," she added. "I'll send it far out to look down on you and patch it into your..."
"Fuck."
"What?" Cast demanded immediately. "No drone. Just get to the shuttle bay. Double time."
"Huh, you try fucking double time in these things." But Cast was moving, the point of the arrow, and his team shambled into place, step after hulking metal step along the hull.
"And let me guess, drone bay after the shuttle, right?"
"Well done." The drone had simply not got out of the bay, hanging tangled in webbing that its sensors could not even detect, its launch hatch still open. Holston had no idea what sort of access the drone bays gave to the rest of the ship, but Lane was already sending people that way, so presumably that meant the creatures were aboard. They had camera feeds from Cast and a handful of his people, though by no means all, recording their slogging progress outside on the hull, constantly surveying the ground before them, over that truncated horizon.
"Blind!" hissed Lane furiously.
The network of hull sensors was in pieces, hundreds of maintenance hours of damage inflicted in just minutes.
"Where are they, then? Where else?"
Holston opened his mouth, another chance for a trite and meaningless remark, and then alarms began to go off.
"Hull breach in cargo,"
Alpash said flatly, and then, with a curious deadness to his tone, "That's the second breach, of course, after the impact earlier."
"There's already a hole in cargo,"
Lane echoed the sentiment, eyes seeking out Holston's.
"They're probably already inside."
"Then why make another hole?"
"Cargo's big," Alpash said. "They must be boring in all over the ship. They don't need hatches. We..."
His eyes were wide as he looked at Lane beseechingly.
"What are we going to do?"
"Cargo." Holston thought of those thousands of sleepers, oblivious in their little plastic coffins. He thought of spiders descending upon them, coasting in the gravity-free vacuum towards their prey. He thought of eggs. Perhaps Lane harboured similar thoughts.
"Cast!"
she snapped.
"Cast, we need your people inside. We're coming up on the shuttle bay hatch now,"
Cast reported, as though he hadn't heard.
"Cast! They're inside!" Lane insisted.
There was a pause, though the clomping progress of the cameras didn't slow.
"Get people there from the inside. I'll deal with this, then we'll head back in. Or do you want them actually right outside your door?" "Cast, cargo is without gravity and atmosphere. I can't just send..."
Lane started.
"Let me kill this nest, and then we'll be back,"
Cast spoke over her.
"We'll keep a lid on it. Don't worry."
He sounded maddeningly calm. Then another transmission came in from aboard the ship. A moment of garbled shouting and screaming, then nothing. Silence followed. Lane and Alpash and Holston stared at one another, appalled.
"Who was that?"
the ancient engineer asked at last.
"Alpash, what did we..."
"I don't know. I'm trying.
Call in, please. Call in. All..."
There was a flurry of brief acknowledgements from different groups of the tribe and reawakened military across the ship, and Holston could see Alpash checking them off. Even before they had finished, someone was shouting,
"They're here! Get out! Get out! They're inside!"
Confirm your position.
Alpash's voice was strained.
Lorry, confirm your position.
Alpash, Lane started.
That's my family, the young engineer said.
He was away from his station suddenly.
That's our living quarters. They're all in there. My kin. Our children.
Alpash, stay at your post, Lane ordered him, hand trembling on her stick. But her authority, the leverage of her age and pedigree, was right now just smoke. Alpash had the hatch open and was gone.
There they are,
came Karst's triumphant shout over the comms. And then,
where are the rest of them?
Lane's mouth opened, her eyes dragged irresistibly towards the screens. There was a handful of spiders about the shuttle bay hatch, caught in the glare of the sun, long angular shadows cast down the length of the hull. Less, though, than there had been, and perhaps that just meant that the others had gone for easier access points. The chaos over the comms showed that the creatures were establishing beachheads all over the ship.
Karst,
from Lane, surely too quietly for him to respond. Holston saw one of the spiders abruptly shatter, torn open by a shot from Karst or one of his team. Then someone shouted,
"Behind us!"
And the camera views were swinging around, giving wheeling views of the hull and the stars.
"I'm caught!"
came from someone, and others of the security team were no longer moving. Holston saw one man, pinned in the camera view of a comrade, fighting something unseen, slapping and pulling at his suit, the drifting net of threads that had ensnared him invisible, yet too strong to break. The spiders were emerging then, racing along the curve of the hull with a speed that laughed at Karst's plodding progress. Others were steering down from above, where they had been drifting at the end of more thread, climbing up against the outwards force of the rotating section, climbing to where they could leap on Karst and his men. Karst's upraised gun glove, at the corner of his camera, flashed and flared, trying to track the new targets, killing at least one. They saw one of Karst's people being hit by friendly fire, boots torn off the hull by the impact, falling away from the ship to end up jerking on the end of an unseen line, as an eight-legged monster came inching up towards his helpless, flailing form. Men and women were shouting, shooting, screaming, trying to run away at their leaden, crippled pace. Karst stumbled back two heavy paces, still shooting, seeing his helmet display record the remaining rounds in his helical magazine. More by luck than judgment, he picked one of the creatures off as it alighted on the woman next to him, spraying freezing pieces of carapace and viscera that rattled as they bounced off him. She was caught in the webbing the little bastards had seeded the hull with, just great loose clouds of the fine stuff that had half his people now completely ensnared. His ears were full of people shouting. His team, others from inside the ship, even Lane. He tried to remember how to shut down the channels. It was all too loud. He couldn't think. The thunder of his own hoarse breathing roared over it, like a hyperventilating giant bellowing at each ear. He saw another of his people fly loose from the hull, cancelling the grip of his boots without anything else to secure him. He just flew away, ascending into the infinite. If his suit had thrusters, they weren't working now. The luckless man just kept going, receding into the infinite, as though he just could not abide to share the ship with the busy monsters intent on getting inside it. Another spider landed on the trapped woman beside Karst, just sailing in at the end of a colossal leap, its legs outstretched. He could hear her screaming, and he stumbled forwards, trying to aim at the thing as the woman flailed and bludgeoned at it with her gloved hands. It was clinging to her, and Karst saw it carefully line up its mouthparts, or some mechanism attached to them, and then hunch forwards, lancing her between the plates of her suit, with sudden, irresistible force. The suit would seal around a puncture, of course, but that would not help against whatever she had been injected with. Karst tried to call up medical information from her suit, but he could not remember how. She had gone still, just swaying limply against the anchor point of her magnetic boots. Whatever it was quick-acting. He finally managed to turn off all the voices in his head, leaving only his own. There was a moment of blessed calm, in which it seemed possible, somehow, that he could regain control of the situation. There would be some magic word, some infinitely efficacious command that a truly gifted leader could give, one that would restore the rightful arrow of evolution and allow humanity to triumph over these aberrations. Something landed on his back. Chapter 7.8 The War Inside. Like an ant colony, is Portia's thought. It is not true, though, just something she tells herself to counter the vastly alien surroundings that weigh upon her. She comes from a city that is a forest, filled with complex many-sided spaces, and yet the architects of her people have cut even that three-dimensional geography down to their own size, compartmentalizing the vast until it is manageable, controllable. Here the giants have done the same, making chambers that for them are perhaps a little cramped and constricting, but to Portia, the exaggerated scale of it all is frightening, a constant reminder of the sheer size and physical power of the godlike beings that created this place, and whose descendants dwell here still. Worse is the relentless geometry of it. Portia is used to a city of 1,000 angles, a chain of walls and floors and ceilings strung at every possible slant, a world of taut silk that can be taken down and put back up, divided and subdivided, and endlessly tailored to suit. The giants must live their lives amongst these rigid, unvarying right angles, entombed between these massive, solid walls. Nothing makes any attempt to mimic nature. Instead, everything is held in the iron hand of that dominating, alien aesthetic. Her peer group is through the savage shuttle bay doors, the breach sealed up behind them to minimize pressure loss. She has just had a brief window of radio contact with other groups, a hurried catch-up before the giants change their own frequency and obliterate all the others with their invisible storm. There are 6 separate peer groups within the great ship now, several of them in a section that had no air of its own. Attempts to coordinate are hopeless. Every troop is on its own. They encounter the first defenders shortly afterwards, perhaps 20 giants arriving with violent intent before the spiders can set up their large-scale weapons. The vibrations of the enemy's approach serves as forewarning of an almost absurd degree, and Portia's band, a dozen of them now, are able to set an ambush. A hastily woven spring trap catches the front-running giants in a mess of poorly constructed webbing, not enough to hold them for long, but enough to drag them to a stop where their fellows will crash into them. They have weapons, not just the lethally swift projectiles of their compatriots outside, but also a kind of focused vibration that runs like mad screaming through every fibre of Portia's body, shocking all the spiders into motionlessness and killing one outright. Then the spiders begin shooting back. The weapons slung beneath their bodies are far slower than bullets, closer to the ancient slingshots Portia's ancestors used. Their ammunition is 3-pronged glass darts, formed to spin in flight. Here, in gravity, their range is relatively short, but the interior of the Gilgamesh does not allow for much long-distance marksmanship anyway. Portia and her peers are, at the very least, extremely good shots, excellent judges of distance and relative motion. Some of the giants wear armour like those outside. Most do not. When the darts draw blood, they snap, tips shearing off and their contents being forced into the curiously elaborate circulatory systems the giants boast, to be hurried about their bodies by their own racing metabolisms. Only a tiny amount is needed for full effect, and the carefully measured concoction works very swiftly, going straight for the brain. Portia watches the giants drop, spasming and going rigid, one by one. The few armoured enemy are dealt with by the more risky approach of direct injection. Portia loses 4 of her squad, and knows that if the ambush had failed, they might all have died. Still, their numbers within the ship are growing steadily. Whilst she would rather survive, she has always accepted the reasonable chance that this mission would mean her death. Her field chemist is still alive and ready for orders. Portia does not stint. The messenger said there will be vents to allow circulation of air about the vessel. The precise logistics of keeping the living quarters of an Ark ship supplied with breathable air are somewhat beyond Portia's understanding, but Avrana Kern's information has been understood to the degree required. Their hairy bodies sensitive to movement even through their vacuum coating, the spiders quickly track down the faint motion of air from the vents. Out there, Portia knows, there will be armies of giants mustering, no doubt expecting the spiders to come against them. But that is not the plan. The field chemist sets up her weapon swiftly, preparing the elegantly crafted mixture to discharge into the air ducts, where it will find its way around the ship. "Move on," Portia orders when she is done. They have plenty more such chemical weapons to put in place. There are a large number of giants on the ship, after all. When they understood at last what Avrana Kern had been trying to communicate with them, when it became obvious that the path their species travelled would bring them inevitably into collision with a civilization of giant creator gods, the spiders turned to the past for inspiration, seeking out learning buried since the early days of their history. But for them, history could be remembered like yesterday. They had never suffered the problem with human records, that so much is lost forever as the grinding wheel of the years groans on. Their distant ancestors, in conjunction with the nanovirus, evolved the ability to pass on learning and experience genetically, direct to their offspring, a vital stepping stone in a species with next to no parental care. So it is that knowledge of far distant times is preserved in great detail, initially passed from parents to their brood, and later distilled and available for any spider to incorporate into mind and genes. Globally, the spiders have assembled a vast library of experience to draw upon, a facility that has contributed to their swift rise from obscurity to orbit. Hidden in this arachnid Alexandria are remarkable secrets. For example, generations ago, during the Great War with the Ants, there were giants that walked briefly upon the Green World, crew from the selfsame Ark ship that Portia has now invaded. One of those giants was captured and held for many long years. The understandings of the time did not include the belief that it was sentient, and scientists now twitch and skitter in frustration at what might have been learned had their forebears only tried a little harder to communicate. However, that is not to say that nothing was learned at all from the captive giant. During its lifetime, and especially after its eventual death, the scholars of the time did their best to examine the creature's biochemistry and metabolism, comparing it to the small mammals they shared their world with. In their library of first-hand knowledge, the spiders uncovered a great deal of how human biochemistry works. Armed with that knowledge, and a supply of mice and similar animals as test subjects, not ideal but the best they had, the spiders developed their great last-ditch weapon against the invaders. There was much argument between the chosen representatives of cities and great peer groups, and between them all and Avrana Kern as well. Other solutions and possibilities were pared away, until the spider's nature and the extremity of the situation left only this one. Even now, Portia and the other assault squads are the first to find out that their solution works, at least for now. The Gilgamesh's sensors barely register the concoction as it passes into the ship's circulation, creeping about the rotating crew section one chamber at a time. There are no overt toxins, no immediately harmful chemicals. Some readouts across the ship begin to record a slight change in the composition of the air, but by then the insidious weapon is already wreaking havoc. The giant warriors Portia has just defeated have been injected with a concentrated form of the drug. Portia now examines them curiously. She sees their strange, weirdly mobile eyes twitch and jerk, dragged up and about and around by the sight of invisible terrors as the substance attacks their brains. Everything is going according to plan. She wants to stay and bind them, but they do not have the time, and she does not know if mere silk could restrain such gigantic monsters. She must hope that the initial incapacity, seen in the mammal test subjects as well, has the intended permanent consequences. It would be inconvenient if the giants somehow recovered. Portia's people move on, swift and determined. The substance is harmless to their own physiology, passing over their book lungs without effect. Shortly after, they come to a room filled with giants. These are not armed, and they are in several sizes, which Portia surmises to be adult and juveniles of various moltings. They are already succumbing to the invisible gas, staggering drunkenly about, collapsing on suddenly fluid legs, or just lying there, staring at sights that exist only in their own minds. There is a strong organic scent in the air, though Portia does realise that many of her victims have soiled themselves. They check that there is nobody left to fight them. Then they move on. There are plenty more giants to conquer. Chapter 7.9 Last Stand. They could hear Cast shouting and screaming for an appallingly long time, his microphone fixed on an open channel. His suit camera gave them blurred glimpses of hull, stars, other struggling figures. Lane was shouting at him in a cracked voice, urging him to get inside the ship, but Cast was past hearing her, instead fighting furiously with something they could not see. From the fumbling of his gloves, glimpsed briefly in the periphery of the image, it looked as though he was trying to pry his own helmet off. Then abruptly, he cut off, and for a moment they thought he had simply ceased transmitting, but his channel remained open. And now they heard a gurgling sound, a wet choking. The wild movement of the camera had ceased, and the starfield drifted past Cast's view, almost peacefully. "Oh, no, no, no," Lane got out, before a segmented leg arched up from beyond the camera's view to plant itself on Cast's faceplate. They only saw a piece of the thing as it crouched on his shoulder, bunching itself for better purchase. A hairy arachnid with a shimmering exoskeleton, and the suggestion of curved fangs within some kind of mask, man's oldest fear, waiting for him here at the outer reach of human expansion, already equipped for space. There were reports coming in from all across the ship by then. Teams of engineers were suiting up, lightweight work suits, without any of the armour or systems that had done Cast so little good, and heading into the hostile, contested territory of the cargo holds. Others were trying to repel boarders wherever the scuttling creatures had entered. The problem was that with the hull sensors torn up in so many places, the Gilgamesh could only make a poor guess at precisely where they had broken in. For bitter minutes, Lane tried to coordinate the various groups, some of them out there on command orders, others just vigilantes from the tribe, or woken cargo who had been awaiting a replacement suspension chamber. Then something changed around them. Holston and Lane exchanged glances, both knowing instantly that something was wrong, but neither able to quite say what. Something ubiquitous, never consciously noted, and always taken for granted, had gone away. And at the last, Lane said, "Life support." Holston felt his chest freeze at the very thought. "What?" "I think..." She looked at her screens. "Air circulation has ceased. The vents have shut off. Which means..." "Which means don't do any more breathing than you have to, because we're suddenly short on oxygen." "What the fuck is..." "Lane?" The old engineer screwed her face up.
"Vetus, what's going on?"
"I've shut the air off, Lane." There was a curious tone to the scientist's voice, somewhere between determined and frightened. Lane's eyes were fixed on Holston, trying to take strength from him.
"Would you care to explain why?"
"The spiders have released some sort of chemical or biological weapon. I'm segmenting the ship, cutting off areas that haven't been infected yet."
"Cutting off areas that haven't been infected?"
"I'm afraid it's quite widespread," Vetus's voice confirmed almost briskly, like a doctor trying to cover bad news with a smile. "I think I can work around those areas and restore a limited air circulation that's uncontaminated. But for now..."
"How do you know all this?" Lane demanded.
"My assistants in the lab have all collapsed. They're suffering some sort of fit. They're completely oblivious." A tiny, swiftly quashed tremor lay behind the words. "I myself am in a sealed test chamber. I was working on a biological weapon of my own to win the war, annihilate the species without having to fire a shot. How could we know they'd beat us to it?"
"I don't suppose that's near completion?" Lane asked, without much hope.
"I'm close, I think.
The Gilgamesh's records on Old Earth zoology are rather incomplete.
Lane, we're going to have to
root uncontaminated air, the engineer finished. She was hunched over a console.